A t-shirt and jeans, mac and cheese. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors. The difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Learn why at Schwabvious.com.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
All right, everybody. I'm going to run through some terms before we get started here. But first, I just wanted to welcome everybody to our Aging in America and its Financial Healthcare Implications space. This is sponsored by Quipt and Unusual Relations. Given that this is a sponsored space, it's important to note some of the terms of this space. So while we wait on the speakers to be all ready to go, I'm going to go ahead and run through this disclaimer. And it again, it is pinned at the top of the space as well for those wishing to read it and refer to later. This space is not financial advice. The stock market is risky, and any trade or investment is expected to have some or total loss. Please do your own research before taking any trade or trading any derivatives. Do not use any information from this space for financial decisions or for investing. Additionally, Unusual Whales nor Unusual Relations are not responsible for any given promotion. It does not verify the authenticity of the promotion or partnership, nor the merits of the individual promotion. There's no endorsement directly of any one promotion. Please do your own due diligence and research before following any one promoted post, and do not consider a promotion of a post to be advocacy for the sponsor of the post. Unusual Whales contracted by Unusual Relations, who's being paid to promote the sponsor to run this space. All right, everybody, we can dive right into this. My name is Nicholas. I'll be the host of this space. I'll be running the questions, etc. Since this is a new kind of space we're trying, we'll be working with some physicians and companies to delve into this broader topic. Today, again, we'll be talking about aging in America and its financial implications. We're excited to have these great speakers who will provide their thoughts as always. Now, as those who frequent our unusual spaces know, I like to keep these panels very open and fluid for discussion. So as we go, all panelists that are involved, please feel free to discuss openly, add in your thoughts on any given topic that you want to add in some thoughts to. The only request that I have is when other speakers are speaking, please keep your microphone muted. Sometimes we get a lot of overhead, distortion, microphones battling with each other, some background noise. So if possible, if you have a point to add, please tap on the emoji to raise your hand here in the space, or at least wait until the previous speaker has finished speaking. So with all of that said, again, feel free to plug anything you're working on, speakers, as I introduce you here at the beginning. And as always, folks, we're fortunate to have many speakers, and I'll introduce them here. We first have Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. He is a professor of medicine, economics, and health research policy at Stanford. He's also, fittingly for this space specifically, the director of Stanford's Center for Demography and Economics of Health and Aging. He's also worked a lot on COVID and its effects largely. Welcome, Dr. Bhattacharya. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for inviting me.
And thanks for coming, of course. I'm excited to hear your input here. Next, we have Dr. Jesse Morse. He's a sports medicine physician specializing in regenerative medicine at the Osteopathic Center in Miami. He's discussed numerous sports injuries on Twitter, and we're excited to hear him discuss the injuries that are expected to occur with an aging population. Welcome, Dr. Morse.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming. Up next, we've got Dr. Janet Neshwat. She is a family and emergency medicine doctor. She's seen different healthcare around the world, leading medical relief missions, and is a medical news correspondent and medical director at CityMD. Welcome, Dr.
Hey,
Neshwat.
Hey, Nicholas. It's so great to be with you today.
It's great to have you here. So we've got a lot going on in this space, and I believe we're waiting for one sponsor as well. So I do want to bring them up before we dive into it. Today's sponsor for the space is Quipt Home Medical Corporation, a home medical equipment provider. The company provides in-home monitoring and disease management services focused on end-to-end respiratory solutions for patients at home in the United States healthcare market. The company has over 270,000 active patients across 26 states and is focusing on patients with heart or pulmonary disease, sleep disorders, reduced mobility, and other chronic health conditions. We'll be having the CEO, Greg Crawford, joining our space later on. Unusual Relations has also joined the space, a company focusing on developing new investor relations with companies. They'll work with your company to help with PR distribution and audience growth. Thank you both for sponsoring. Check them out at unusualrelations.com. But for now, I think we can dive right in. So we're going to start with you, Dr. Bhattacharya. We'd like to take a look at something you published on the consequences of health trends and medical innovation for the future elderly. You concluded that, quote, is unlikely that a silver bullet will emerge to both improve health and dramatically reduce spending. Dr. Bhattacharya, can you touch on that a little bit?
Sure. So it's obviously bad news as far as expecting a technological fix. Just very briefly on the nature of the problem and why we have it. The problem fundamentally is a problem of success. Except for the last couple of years, for obvious reasons, the life expectancy has been increasing very sharply throughout the world over the last several decades. And longer even. That's actually good news, right? But at the same time, it puts tremendous pressure on countries to care for populations, older populations, because you have many more of them. And the math of it is inexorable. Like, so if you look at the projections, the populations of many countries in the West, as well as, Japan, Korea, China, we're going to be experiencing actual population decline starting in the next few decades. For instance, just to give some sense of this, Japan is projected to decline from 120 million population to something on the order of 80 million within just a few years, maybe a decade or so, two or three decades. So you have this success, tremendous success of keeping people alive longer, that comes with consequences for demands on governments to care for these populations as they age. Now, you might think that all what you need is just some technological fix in order to keep populations healthy up until the moment they die. The problem is that the math of it doesn't work. If you look at, for instance, something very, very simple and so you can think about is, imagine we had a cheap cure for cancer, something that cured every single cancer essentially for free. That would decrease the healthcare costs in one sense, because you wouldn't be spending money on cancers. Let's say it was a really inexpensive cure. That would decrease healthcare costs, but it would keep patients alive longer, and they would then die of other things, because, that we don't have the technology and not going to ever have one that staves off deaths forever. And so you actually could increase or only marginally decrease healthcare costs in countries if you had a technology even that was cheap that cured cancer. So disease by disease improvements in technology, while they're good for people, of course, because no one wants to die of cancer, it's certainly worth investing in, is not a solution to the fiscal problems that governments face from aging populations. I think that's really a fundamental message that these things, which I think we all think is good, improvements in health and longevity, and improvements in technology so that we can stay healthy for longer, come with costs, and it's costs that we ought to be willing to pay, or at least think about paying. We shouldn't expect them and hold it in the standard of reducing expenditures and solve this fiscal problem, which I honestly don't know a solution to.
Thank you, Jay. And we'll definitely double back to that last point later on in the space as well, I think. For now, Dr. Neshwa, you've discussed at length policy and healthcare needs of the aging population on Fox and Friends. What do you think are the most necessary policy to address the economic needs of the aging U.S. population? And as well, if you have any comments on what Jay said, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, and I totally agree with what Dr. Jay said. Absolutely. You know, if you take a look at the average lifespan around 73 years of age, and that may change as we advance our medicine, our technology. Which is a blessing, but bittersweet, because if you look at the state of the economy and the inflation that we're dealing with, although inflation has gone down recently, we're still triple of what we were, you know, a year ago, so at about 3%. And so with a fast aging population, usually that means fewer people are working in the economy. But with inflation, we're seeing elderly. I'm seeing my elderly patients, sadly, come out of retirement. Especially because of the fact that a fifth of older Americans have had to spend, you know, $2,000 to $3,000 out of pocket on healthcare in the past month alone. So, you know, from a medical perspective, they're unable to make ends meet, meaning they're not able to get their insulin. They're not able to pick up their blood pressure medicines in a timely manner because of the cost of the other basic necessities. And so that's disheartening for me to see. That's why now more than ever, I think it's critical that we really try to focus on having consistent plans and protocols in place that focus on prevention, meaning are my patients getting their mammograms? Are they getting their colonoscopies? Do they qualify to have a PSA level checked? Do they have, a geriatrician or a PCP that understands what is the most prevalent medical conditions in their age group? And that way we stay two steps ahead of it so that we can tackle it, predict it, see if they have a family history, for example. But all of this, you know, combined, if you think about it, it's a strain as we get older, as we have an aging population with more baby boomers. It's a strain on the healthcare system right now. And just, think about what's one of the greatest financial burdens in our country. On our government, it's healthcare. We spend about more than $900 billion every year on healthcare. Medicare, $755 billion, and those numbers are growing. So, taking that into consideration and coming up with plans and protocols to address these complex issues and factors that we're seeing now that we didn't see 10 to 20 years ago is something that we really have to make changes. Otherwise, we're going to see more seniors that have more progressive disease that aren't properly managed. So it's sort of a cycle, and it's more difficult and compounded by the fact that we have a shortage of doctors, especially primary care doctors, to help address and understand these needs. So, we just have to continue debates and sessions like this one, Nicholas, in order to address these issues and promote awareness so that we can tackle and take care of our elderly population who do have higher healthcare costs as older individuals typically do, which strains not only them, but also, you know, programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and even their families.
I don't think anyone could have said that better themselves, Dr. Neshwat. Thank you. Dr. Morse, quick question for you. With your specialty in rehabilitative medicine, you've noted that many are using new varied treatment with or without evidence for healing injuries. So what are some of these medical equipments and what do you see as the economic impact of them?
Great question. So I approached the body a little bit differently. I started family medicine and then I decided that big pharma and big insurance were making practicing primary care almost impossible. And I wasn't a big fan of seeing patients in 10 to 15 minute intervals and then spending 3 hours writing notes at the end of the day. So I decided to specialize in sports medicine. And then when that same mindset changed into sports medicine, I said, you know what, I'm going out of network and actually treating patients the way they deserve to be treated and seeing them for 45 minutes to an hour at a time. What I began is that when you get to actually listen to the patient and they tell you it's wrong, you can actually help to solve the problems with them. It's very hard to do in 10 to 15 minute intervals. especially if you're making them come back every week to basically finish the same conversation. What you start to see is a combination of accumulation of toxins, poor dietary habits, and then an addition of decreasing exercise, low vitamin D levels, and all of it starting to accumulate where their joints can no longer handle it. They become weaker and osteoporotic. And if they fall and were to break a hip or injure their knee, it becomes much, much more difficult to ambulate, to move around, to even, have a normal quality of life. So, I'm more proactive than reactive, or at least I try to be. And many of the different technologies and treatments we've been using for 30 or 40 years. And unfortunately, it's a combination between the studies not wanting to be completed, or they just take so long to complete, and we've just been using them so long. We know they work, and the risk profile is really low. Something along the lines of PRP, which is platelet-rich plasma, pulling blood out of the arm, spinning it down, grabbing the plasma and the cytokines, and then injecting it back into the knee, hip, the shoulder, the low back, wherever you want to put it. That's what I personally specialize in. But then you can take it a step further and either take bone marrow out or take stem cells out of your fat, out of your adipose. And they even have stem cell lines that are from either amniotic tissue or something called exosomes. And each of these are massive doses of anti-inflammatory agents that basically decrease a lot of the inflammation, a lot of the issues, and help to re-stabilize the tissue so it can handle the load. My goal is to prevent someone from ever having to need a knee or hip replacement, because your body made the perfect form of a joint. So you will never get an arthritic joint, you'll never get a joint to be perfect in the form of a metal joint. You'll just never, the prosthetic is never as good as your original. So you ideally want to keep your original as long as you can. And unfortunately, the poor dietary habits have led to increased obesity rates, which has led to an increased injury rate, predominantly in the knee and the hip. And that has a kind of snowball effect. So people are having to have surgery earlier because their joints cannot simply handle the amount of stress we've added to it. Then you add the amount of inflammation into the diet, and at that point you they're completely inflamed, they're in a lot of pain, they can't move a whole lot, and they're miserable. So I work in my clinic on not only decreasing the issues directly at the joint level if they want that, but I also remove a lot of the toxins, whether it's heavy metals or mold or any chronic viruses or COVID or Lyme disease or anything along those lines. Those are often underlying issues that are often overlooked, and they're causing significant detriment to the body.
All right. Now, does anybody, before we move on to the next question, have anything to add to what any of the other panelists have said thus far? All right, so Dr. Jesse and Dr. Neshwat both spoke about increases in costs and an increase in underlying issues. Dr. Bhattacharya, you wrote in your 2004 paper, Disability Forecasts and Future Medicare Costs, that, quote, cost forecasts for the elderly that incorporate information about disability among today's younger generations yield more pessimistic scenarios than those based solely on elderly data sets. And this information should be incorporated into official Medicare forecasts. Now, Jay, how do you see the disability landscape in the aging U.S. population currently?
Thank you for that, Nicholas. So in 2004, what we were looking at was a rising obesity and chronic disease in working age populations. And we were forecasting that forward as these folks aged, what would happen to them relative to what had happened to their parents. Remember, we're talking about a background where life expectancy is increasing, while at the same time, chronic disease, obesity, and its consequent diseases that come with obesity are also increasing. And so you have a long-lived, relatively unhealthy population. And when you forecast that forward, it makes for kind of depressing reading, actually. In a sense, like, again, it's a success that we are living longer. But we have not had very much success in addressing the underlying chronic disease problems in the population. Obesity rates in particular have continued to rise since that forecast in 2004. And many of the projections that we made, at least qualitatively, have come to pass, that we now actually have a population in the United States and actually in many other developed countries of long-lived, relatively unhealthy people. The technological fixes for this are people have continued to try to find technological fixes. For instance, Ozempic, this anti-obesity drug, and other things. I mean, I think I very strongly think that it's a good idea to try to find these. But the fundamental issue, which is the population itself, is becoming less and less metabolically healthy, less and less fit, while still living longer, hasn't been solved. And I don't see anything on the horizon technologically that would address that. And until that happens, what we'll have is technological fixes and technological proposals that will address particular needs. And again, I'm in favor of those things, but they will not address the fiscal challenges of caring for population. So for instance, in particular, Medicare, which in the United States pays for health insurance for people over 65 and for severely disabled populations, the fiscal challenge for Medicare are tremendous. Part A trust fund is scheduled to go bankrupt sometime around 2030. Not that many years from now. The fixes basically that have been implemented for Medicare spending over the last decade or so have essentially focused on trying to limit expenditure growth. What that means is pay less. Pay less to doctors, pay less to hospitals, and of course, there's tremendous pushback from those groups to try to reverse that. So what we have is a situation where I think if we look at it seriously, we may come to some conclusion about what to do, but it's going to involve fundamental trade-offs unless there's some magic bullet that actually makes us age and stay healthy at the same time, which I've not seen. The kinds of technological advances we've had are likely to increase, not decrease, the kind of tension we're going to face in coming years over the fiscal pressures of caring for older populations.
Thank you, Jay. Does anybody have anything to add to what Jay just said?
Please. Yeah, I'd like to comment on a couple of things.
Yeah, please.
So I think a lot of the problem, especially in American medicine, is we are way too reactive and not proactive enough. Rarely is a physician comfortable with discussing nutrition and discussing really anything related to nutrition. Most physicians don't have the time to discuss nutrition. And at the end of the day, the American diet is awful, and all the different additives that are put into the food, and just the fact that gluten has changed probably 30 times over, our body doesn't have any idea what to do with it, and all the different seed oils are further causing further inflammation. The issue with American medicine and I would say medicine in general is that we're doing a lot of managing. We're not treating. When I see a patient that says, hey, and you had a heart attack, when is the expectation that you're going to be off your blood pressure medicine when you die? That's not a management. Excuse me, that's not a treatment, that's a management. So that's the assumption, is that the medicine is only good when you take it. But you're not treating anything. You're just waiting for it to not get worse. Why don't you actually address the core issue and remove a lot of the issues that are causing these problems, and also improve the mitochondrial health of that person so that they can actually heal and boost their immune system? So you don't have to worry about if they come in contact with XYZ virus or bacteria or whatever, because their immune system's strong enough, they can actually treat it.
And Nicholas, if I just may add, I really think that Dr. Jesse and Jay just hit the nail on the head. And we really do need to see this paradigm shift away from just diagnosis and treatment to more of prevention, education, and ensuring accessibility of affordable, high-quality healthcare, especially for those who have difficulty, Hispanics, African-Americans, those in rural communities, poverty-stricken communities that don't understand the importance of prevention. And as a primary care doctor and emergency medicine doctor, you know, when you think about what are the top killers in our country of Americans, it's heart disease, it's cancer, it's accidents, all of which are preventable.
Really, really good point. So I do want to hear a little bit from Greg here, someone who excels in providing affordable and high quality health care there at Quipt. Greg, can you hear us?
Yes.
Perfect.
Good afternoon.
Beautiful. Good afternoon. Thanks for coming, man. I'm glad that we're able to get you up here now. So I do have a question specifically for you, Greg, here. Welcome back. Now, Dr. Neshwat there at the beginning spoke about the increase in medical costs that are growing exponentially and exceptionally. For those who don't know, Quipt is a respiratory and a home medical equipment provider. In Quipt's recent earnings report, Greg, you said the company continues to experience robust demand for respiratory equipment such as oxygen concentrators, ventilators, as well as the CPAP resupply and other supplies business. And you also reported a customer base increase of 58% year over year to 140,515 unique patients served in fiscal Q3 2023. And Greg, a couple questions here on that. Where is that increase coming from? And how much can be contributed to an aging population in the U.S.? And how does the company handle population decline and age, as Jay and Dr. Neshwat said?
Yeah, absolutely. All very good questions in that. I mean, we've got some really bullish tailwinds in our industry in that's really kind of propelling it. But just to kind of back up, the DME market itself in that is sitting at about $60 billion. It's expected to grow to over $80 billion in that. So it's growing at about 5 to 6% a year. And some of the things that are kind of pushing the industry in that forward in that for demand in that would be the aging population. You've got 10,000 people expected to turn 65 or older every day. There's over 16 million COPD sufferers in the U.S. Those are some of our key target markets. And then as it relates to sleep therapy and that for sleep apnea, which is a big part of our market, it's estimated that there's over 24 million Americans in that are undiagnosed that are suffering from severe sleep apnea. So there's no shortage in that of patients out there that could potentially need our services.
Thank you, Greg. So a couple of follow-up questions to that. And then, Jay, after these next few questions, I'll have you chime in with your thoughts as well. So, Greg, what is the size of the DME market? And could you also explain DME for those who don't know?
Yeah, sure. So, like I said before, the estimated market right now is about $60 billion. It's growing organically at about 5 to 6% a year. And the DME market, and that just DME stands for durable medical equipment. And that would be items in that primarily on the respiratory side is what our company provides, such as home oxygen services, CPAPs, BiPAPs. We also provide other types of equipment solutions, such as ambulatory aids, mobility devices, hospital beds, wheelchairs, different things like that. We also carry all kinds of different medical supplies, whether it be wound care, urological type supplies.
Thank you. So just to kind of piggytail off of that, with that reiterated, does Quipt see a positive effect of aging on the company itself?
Yes, absolutely. And that, I mean, that's why we're seeing the robust growth in that, that we've seen in that within our company, and that really even over the past 5 years in that or so, and that the company's basically went from about $50 million in revenue now, and that to performing out, and that to just about over $240 million now. Some of that has came from acquisitions in that as we've consolidated and expanded across the United States.
Thank you. So real quick, before we move into that line of thinking, I know Jay had something to mention as well from a previous question, and then I do want to kick it around the panel for any other comments before we move on. Jay?
Thanks, Nicholas. So I had a one thought that occurred to me is after from listening to this discussion. One thing that's very important we haven't really talked about is that people differ very, very much in their capacity to access these technologies. Like some of the technologies are vital for managing chronic disease for many people, but not everybody can afford it. And that fact is actually quite important when you think about what the technologies will do if they're expensive and you have Medicare covers them, you know, like through this DME program, a DME, and that you can basically get it if you're over 65. If you have technologies that are not accessible through insurance, some of the emerging technologies, it poses a challenge for the companies themselves, because then they can't get a market for them. But also, to me, even more importantly, you exacerbate this sort of inequality in society where the relatively well off have access to technologies that make their lives better, that manage the chronic diseases they have, while at the same time for people who are less well off, especially since it's not covered through insurance, they don't have access to these technologies. It just sort of exacerbates whatever income inequalities there are by introducing or exacerbating health inequalities, especially for technologies that are effective. So these are like major challenges, I think, from a policy perspective, because if insurance covers things, and it's just, you know, you have this fiscal problem of being able to finance it as the population ages. If insurance doesn't cover it, you have this sort of inequality driving this inequality is sort of exacerbating, getting much worse, expanding from just income into health.
I'd like to just add, if I may, how critical when it comes to Quip and Greg, from a medical perspective, from an outside perspective, the necessity and the valuable need for durable medical equipment truly it can be life-saving. You know, I worked on the front lines of COVID in New York, where we were once the epicenter of the world. And, you know, at the beginning, I had patients who tested positive for COVID. All they needed was home oxygen. But if they come in and see me in the emergency room or in urgent care at 7, 8 o'clock at night, I have one tank or two tanks at max. And so we were forced to send them to the hospital because they didn't have, you know, access to simple tank of home oxygen to keep them out of the hospital. So it's so important, so critical. There's such a great need. So I thank you for what you're doing, Greg. And also, when you think about it, also from another viewpoint, 12 out of 100 adults, 18 and over, are cigarette smokers. And they start young, unfortunately, whether it's with vaping or marijuana, and then they proceed to regular tobacco, nicotine use, and they get hooked and they progress to emphysema, COPD, lung cancers. How many of them do you see that end up needing low-dose, low-flow oxygen? And so, again, points to the value of this durable medical equipment and the necessity for accessibility and affordability.
Really great points. And I think I would agree with you entirely. So on that note, Greg, can you comment on what Jay just said, how DME and insurance affects Quip's outlooks going forward, and how one can follow this trend going forward, given that the revenues have grown year over year, and how your durable and respiratory equipment continue to be resilient and reliable, as Dr. Neschwitz just said?
Yes, absolutely. We play a key role in that, in the healthcare ecosystem, in that overall, especially when you're looking at these hospitals like she was referring to there, and that need to get these patients out of the hospital into the home setting, which Medicare, these insurance companies know this is the least costly alternative, and that to provide the proper care for these patients in the comfort of their own home. And that's really where we come into play. For us, it's really getting our name out there, and that speaking to physicians and different referral sources, and that about the equipment and the services that we provide, and that these patients can benefit from. One thing is too, is that the services that we provide are primarily covered by insurance companies. And in fact, we've even seen some expansion of coverage and coverage criteria, and that for some of these items, in that become a little less lapsed in that since the pandemic, in that. So our demand just continues to grow very strongly.
Thank you, Greg. Sorry about that. Forgot to turn my microphone back on. So real quick, I do want to pivot here a little bit to a report that Jay had put out. In a recent report, Jay, you spoke about the four main keys to future pension and healthcare spending, specifically old age dependency ratio, labor force participation rate, the pension participation rate, and the pension generosity in the future. Can you explain which of these factors are most important for an aging population?
Well, so they all sort of work together to sort of determine both the availability of money for governments to pay for healthcare and the quality of aging for the populations of people as they age. So for instance, the labor force participation rates. The what's happened over the last decades is that the number of elderly individuals who qualify for pension benefits, for you know, Social Security, for health insurance and healthcare benefits, is expanded along with the size of those populations. Of course, there's tremendous inequality, especially in the availability of pension benefits and so on. While at the same time, the workforce per person that's on support has decreased. I mean, I think in the 1980s, the number of workers per retired person people was something on the order of four, and now it's something on the order of two and a half. So you have fewer workers supporting the well-being of older populations. It's going to put a lot of pressure both on the workers to have enough, you know, sort of have enough output to support the needs of the elderly population. And so how do you square this circle? Like, so you end up in a situation where a lot of our politics has to do with the fact that the math just doesn't work. You don't want to reduce the amount of benefits that older folks get, because the quality of life really depends, especially for people on fixed income, on the availability of pension benefits, Social Security benefits, and of course the availability of excellent healthcare, so that people can have a retirement that's with a high quality of life. At the same time, you have workers with tax rates that are higher. You end up with a sense that people won't be able to keep the promises that governments won't be able to keep the promises they make, and so you end up with politics of essentially like politics across generations that are more adversarial than maybe they had been when the population wasn't shrinking and getting older and older. So I think that's really the fundamental thing. I don't know. Again, I don't have an answer to this, but I do see the tension. I don't see how that tension decreases in the future. And I think technology is going to be a very important contributor to try to help with this. I'm not optimistic particularly that technology will solve that particular tension, even as it does make the lives of people but potentially better if they're effective in addressing particular health needs.
Thank you much, Jay. So Greg, since we missed you there at the beginning, I do have a few follow-up questions given the discussion thus far.
Sure.
First, organic growth in Quip has picked up above where it has been historically per your earnings report. What do you see as the leading factor contributing to this, Greg?
Yeah, there's no question. It's the demand for the products and that we've been discussing in that today.
You also recently, Greg, received national contracts with United Health and Aetna. What do these contracts do for you? And is there more to get? Have recent acquisitions helped out in this area?
Yes, absolutely. And that kind of landing two national contracts with two of the largest payers inside the United States. And that is really significant for us. And really what it does is it gives us the ability in that to continue to expand our continuum of care across the United States and that with these contracts and that to be able to serve more lives without having to worry whether or not we can accept the insurance. And there's no question in the geographical expansion in that we've seen over the past several years and that basically growing from about 7 states to now 26 states with over 115 locations. And that has been a big factor in that along with and that the quality of care and that we've provided these patients that's helped us obtain these national contracts. So we think there's still several more to go. We're also working on different regional type contracts also to continue to add more potential lives that we can serve.
And so kind of in that same vein of thought, it's understood that Quip recently made an investment in DME scripts for e-prescribing. Will the future aging population be more technologically advanced? And if so, how will that affect care in the future, Greg?
Yes, DME Scripts, that was an independent e-prescribing company specifically in that for durable medical equipment and supplies. So essentially it gives the physician and that the ability in that to order this equipment in that online really helps reduce a lot of the burdensome paperwork, reduce a lot of the friction points in that to get patients set up timely in that on equipment. So there's no doubt that e-prescribe in that is the future of DME. If you go back a couple decades ago or maybe even more in that you've seen the same thing kind of happen in that in the pharmacy benefit in that where most prescriptions in that are now all coming over in that electronically in that to your pharmacy in that you're really not getting a handwritten prescription. And that has not happened yet in DME, so we think that's still a game changer for us in the future.
Thank you, Greg. Really great responses there. So real quick before we move on to the next panel question, does anyone on the panel have any comments on what Greg said? Maybe any opinions or feedback on the future of e-prescribing?
I would just say it's definitely a necessity, especially when you're not in the office. So looking forward to it.
Fair enough. So I'm going to move into our next line of questions here. The Atlantic recently reported that 90% of all healthcare goes to those aged above 80. With an aging population, we were hoping to discuss how an increasing aging population that will peak in age around 2032 and the general impacts on the economy. Dr. Neshwa, how would an aging population affect the public sector's ability to fund healthcare? For example, Japan has shown that relying on labor markets, such as like social contributions to raise public sector revenues and pay for health and other services will lead to fewer public revenues per person over time. Dr. Neshwa, do we think that we'll go down that path, given what Jay said about worker responsibility to have enough output?
Gosh, you know, it's a possibility, but I hope not. You know, but when you reach a certain age, for example, in the field of family medicine and preventative care, we stop doing certain tests. We don't go chasing. For example, we'll stop doing colonoscopies. We'll stop doing PCA, prostate testing and screenings. So it might be a washout. It really depends on at that age, once you hit that age, what are your current medical conditions? What's your current status? And, you know, what medications are you taking? So, you know, are you suffering from a chronic disease or are you blessed with good health and maybe take no medications? That's a rarity. A lot of our seniors have at least one or two comorbidities, you know, like hypertension or hyperlipidemia or atrial fibrillation and requiring, you know, anticoagulants. But then some doctors, they have the discussion with their patients. How aggressive do you want to be with your health? Are you, coherent? How's your cognitive, mental stability and stamina? Do you want us to go all out? Do you want to just do the minimum? And so it's a case-by-case, individualized, customized situation. I don't think it's a blanket, one-size-fits-all. And again, it's just a matter of where you are at in regards to your health and what is your baseline.
Thank you. I think that makes perfect sense. So kind of in that same vein of thought, currently the census has shown that the U.S. population is older than it's ever been, with the nation's median age now over 38. Currently, 16.5% of the U.S. population of roughly 328 million people, or 54 million, are over the age of 65, as the latest census showed. By 2030, that number is expected to rise to 74 million. Now, Dr. Bhattacharya, is the U.S. prepared for this increase of an aging population?
No, we're not. I think but we're not alone in that. Basically, almost every developed country on Earth is facing exactly that same demographic problem. And the U.S., if in some ways, is better off because we actually have...
Looks like we might have lost you there, Jay. All right, we're going to circle back to that question once he reconnects. Looks like we're having a connection issue there with his microphone. So, Greg, given this U.S. Census info, Quipton, its last earnings, noted a bullish regulatory environment. How do we expect the regulatory environment to change as the population ages, Greg?
Yeah, the reimbursement regulatory environment in that for the DME space, and that has been quite favorable in that for providers in that for the past several years. Once, as I had mentioned earlier, in that we've even seen on the post the pandemic in that CMS in that which makes these rules in that for qualification of this equipment, which is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they've opened up access in that for one of the key product categories, home oxygen. Where they've removed some of the burdensome paperwork. They've also opened up coverage in that for patients in other categories in that, whereas prior a patient would have to be in a chronic stable state before they would actually qualify. Now they could show up into the emergency room and the physician would be able to prescribe home oxygen should they meet the testing criteria there. So those are the kind of things that we continue to see in that in our industry and in that which just allows us to serve more patients. But I think ultimately in that that the CMS is seeing that we actually provide a service and a lower cost solution in that to the overall healthcare system, and that as we're removing some of the burdensome in that off of these hospital systems, which are already overstretched.
So you actually called this the strongest regulatory environment in over a decade. Can you touch on why that is?
Yeah. One of the items in that really kind of driving the foundation of that and that is the industry was subject to a program called the Durable Medical Equipment Competitive Bidding Program, which was first implemented in 2010. And they were on bidding cycles every 3 years. So we had 10, 13, 16, and 19. 19 ended up getting delayed until 2021. And then in 2021, CMS had published that they were going to remove all of the product categories, 13 product categories, which was essentially everything that Quip provided in that to its patients under that coverage from the competitive bidding program. And the reason they were going to remove it was because they didn't achieve the expected savings. So I think it kind of points to that something we had thought as a company and really as an industry is that they had, quote, and that there was no more meat left on the bones for them to do that. And then I also believe in that on the backside of the pandemic here, they seen that the DME industry and that once again could really be a part of the solution to deliver quality care at home at a less expensive cost.
Perfect. Thank you, Greg. Jay, looks like we've got you back. If you'd like to continue your thoughts here on the U.S. preparedness for an aging population.
Sorry, I was disconnected somehow. The problem for the future is that that 74 million that you mentioned, Nicholas, is an enormous fiscal challenge. It's not just 74 million people. It's 74 million people that will have tremendous healthcare needs, that will have tremendous needs for social needs. Just to give some sense of this, the kinds of physicians that we have now. We'll need many more oncologists, many more cardiologists, many more geriatricians. The set of nursing homes we have now are inadequate to care for a population that size. And the financing of all that is also inadequate. And of course there's tremendous inequality in this as well. So where you have a lot of poor elderly that are going to be there. So how do you address that? It's going to take a fundamental change in how we think about healthcare in this country. And the United States in some ways is better off than much of the rest of the developed world, because our population, while it's aging, is aging slightly slower. Slower than some of the other countries. You know, Japan, for instance, has faced tremendous aging. It's going to take a concerted effort and honesty from our policymakers to tell the population to expect there to be fundamental decisions we have to make regarding investments. And I just want to keep just emphasize again and again, it's not we can't expect a technological silver bullet. Technology may play a role, but it may actually make the fiscal problem worse, because it extends life while at expensive things. So we have to make fundamental decisions about what we want to invest in as a society, and I think those conversations are going to happen in a very sharp way over the next coming decade.
Thank you, Dr. Bhattacharya. This goes right in line with what we were discussing. Dr. Neshwat, others have argued for a U-shaped recovery for economic growth with an aging population, where health investment plays a significant role in promoting economic growth. And there is an inverted U-shaped relationship between population aging and the economic growth. Could health investment further benefit populations, Dr. Neshwat?
Nicholas, I lost you. Can you repeat your question?
Yeah, absolutely. So others have argued for a U-shaped recovery for economic growth with an aging population, where health investment plays a significant role in promoting economic growth. And there's also an inverted U-shaped relationship between population aging and economic growth. Could health investment further benefit populations?
I absolutely. And I think it starts with investing in your health at a younger age. And going back to being a primary care doctor and an ER doctor, prevention, education at a young age, at an early age, and encouraging and ensuring, again, affordable, accessible health care with trusted primary care doctors or internists who can lay the foundation and the groundwork for you to make sure you understand the importance of your health at a younger age so that it carries with you throughout life. So what do I mean by health investment? I know you're talking about the financial aspect, but from my perspective is understanding the importance of getting 150 minutes of activity each week, according to the American Health Association, making sure that you're not smoking, making sure that you're managing your stress, making sure that you're getting sufficient hours of sleep, 7 to 8 hours of sleep, and making sure that your weight and your BMI is within normal limits, because what leads to the number one cause of death in this country? Obesity leads to heart disease. Diabetes leads to heart disease. High blood sugars, sedentary lifestyle, high cholesterol leads to heart disease, and one of the top killers in this country. So if we can invest in educational campaigns, educational programs, diabetes education, health education in the communities, can that have a positive impact for the long term? Absolutely.
I think that's a beautiful response. I think investing in your health in general, even on an individual basis, is really important. Although the last time I tried that a few weeks ago, I broke my arm. So here we are.
Oh my goodness. We have our sports doctor on with us can take care of you, right, Dr. Jesse?
Yeah, fix me right up. So Greg, the last question that I've got today is going to go to you. Jay spoke about underserved populations, and Dr. Neshwat spoke about growing health investments in education. Now, I know Quip does education specifically. What are the current trends impacting the need for at-home respiratory treatment, and does the undiagnosed and or unserved populations look like across your major categories, Greg?
Yeah, I think one of the major categories in that we really look at that, you know, could have the biggest impact would be on sleep apnea. We just continue to see very, very strong demand in that for those types of devices. It's estimated there's over 24 million in that undiagnosed in that could potentially have severe sleep apnea. So that's a big category, not to mention in that the over 14 million COPD sufferers in that's estimated in the U.S.
Thank you, Greg. So what I want to do here, it looks like Jesse had to drop off a little early due to being busy, other engagements, which is perfectly fine. But what I want to do is just kind of run down our remaining panelists for any closing thoughts on the subject, anything you wanted to add that you might not have been able to get to. And again, as always, feel free to bring up or plug anything you're working on or anything you feel the listeners should be paying attention to moving forward. Let's go ahead and start here with Jay. Any closing remarks here?
I mean, I think I've been saying very pessimistic things through this whole spaces event, but I have to say that it's not all bad. I think the key thing is to say, what do we want to invest in? New technologies come out, we have to remember we shouldn't necessarily require them to like lower spending. I completely agree with Dr. Neshwat's emphasis on individual things that you can do to improve your health, sleep, improve nutrition, a focus on you know, metabolic health. I think a lot of these things are actually don't involve very expensive interventions, but they do involve a kind of a reorientation of our thinking. At the same time, I do think that the next few years are going to be very challenging, and I don't want to sugarcoat that. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you all. Bye.
And thanks for coming and giving your expertise. Very useful for this panel, Jay. Thank you. Greg, do you have any closing thoughts, anything you wanted to touch on, maybe about Quip or about the environment we're seeing with aging populations here?
Yeah, I think primarily with the aging population in that, and then as it kind of relates to Quip in that, I mean, we're sitting in a very good spot in that to really be able to remove some of the burdensome in that off of the traditional healthcare system in that with being able to treat patients in their home. And also at the same time, it's very cost effective in that for insurance companies to do so. And I think that's why we continue to see a very, very strong demand for our products for the very foreseeable future.
Thank you, Greg. And thanks again for coming. Really good feedback here, especially on the topic of DMEs and their importance moving forward. Thanks again for coming, Greg.
Yes, thanks, everyone.
Dr. Neshwat, last but not least today, do you have any closing remarks or anything you wish you could have talked a bit more about and didn't get to?
I just want to say thank you so much, Nicholas, to you and Unusual Wales. And it's such an honor and privilege to be on with you and Greg and Dr. Jay and Jesse. You know, we all age, and I think one of our greatest investments is in ourselves and in our health. And I'm a huge proponent of prevention. And I just want to point out the value of getting your routine yearly physicals, because us doctors, we're not here just to take care of you when you're sick, but keep in mind that early detection is the key to better outcomes and usually better prognosis when it comes to disease.
Beautifully said, Dr. Neshwat. Thank you again for coming. To all of our listeners, if you want to stay on top of all of the information we spoke about today, please follow all of our speakers. They're experts in their fields. Really good takes, and they're keeping people up to date on what's going on with healthcare in the U.S. and aging population. So please make sure to be following them. for their takes on a broad array of topics. Thanks, everybody, for coming. If you came in late or you missed anything, you didn't miss anything. This was recorded, as always, and will be released later as an Unusual Whales podcast on Spotify and Apple Pod. Thanks again to our sponsors, Quipt and Unusual Relations, and, of course, to Dr. Neshwat, Dr. Bhattacharya, Dr. Morse, and our man, Greg. Thanks for coming, everybody, and we'll catch you on the next one. Take care.